NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The HBO show Succession wrestles with the fate of a global media empire run by a combative, controlling, conservative, and enigmatic mogul who's intent on figuring out just which of his conniving adult children he should entrust the family business to. If that sounds an awful lot like Rupert Murdoch of Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, and New York Post, it should. With healthy dollops of the Redstones at Viacom and CBS, and even a touch of the Kennedys, the themes evoke Shakespeare, the swearing evokes Deadwood, and at its heart sits Logan Roy, overlord of Waystar Royco. He's played by the distinguished Scottish film and stage actor Brian Cox, the very first Hannibal Lecter, who has played key roles in scores of other movies, including The Bourne Supremacy, Churchill, and Rushmore. This hour, On Point, my conversation with Brian Cox. Feel free to join us. For those with a Succession obsession, what draws you to the show? For those who know of Cox's earlier work or his stage work, what questions do you have for my guest? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me, as I said, here in New York City, in studio, is Brian Cox. He's the Emmy-winning actor and star of HBO's Succession, where he portrays the family patriarch and the ailing CEO of the giant media conglomerate. He's also starring on Broadway as the nation's 36th president, Lyndon Johnson, in The Great Society, which opens next Tuesday night here in New York City. Brian Cox, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, and it's my pleasure to be here.
That's a heck of a lead-up, but worth it all. I want to start by playing just a clip for our listeners to set the screen. There are a lot of folks who are big fans of the show, and a lot of folks for whom this may be something of an introduction. The creator of the show, Jesse Armstrong, had been knocking around thinking about a project like this for quite some time. In this interview, Jesse Armstrong explains that the fictional Roy family dynasty is derived from a variety of real-life examples.
If you look at the American media landscape, you have just the big TV networks. You have CBS, owned by Viacom, which is a family business, the Redstones. You have NBC, which is a family business owned by Comcast, the Roberts family. You have ABC, which was Disney, and which is no longer a family firm, but the politics are kind of Byzantine and not unlike our show. You have the Sinclair family, who are buying up most of local TV. You have the Mercer family, who are all over the data mining. You have a lot. There are a lot of influential media families in the U.S. for us to think about and draw on.
So, you know, look, in my day job, I cover media. The Sinclair family, the Smith family down in Baltimore have owned a lot of stuff. The Redstones obviously had in Sumner Redstone somebody who is a nonagenarian and was ailing but still said by his lawyers to be running things until relatively recently. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it strikes me that the Murdochs were at the core of this. How did first off, is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are several influences, but I think Jesse, I think, wrote a treatment for a film about the Murdochs, I think, at one point, or it may have been a script he wrote. But the Murdochs are kind of, they're a kind of spin-off influence, but the Roys are themselves.
Very much.
They are very much unique. The important thing about Logan Roy, as opposed to any of those other people, he didn't inherit anything. He's created it all. And even Murdoch had his old man, you know, with the broadcasts and newspapers in Australia. But Logan is self-made. He's an autodidact. So there's a much more mysterious element to him, which is what makes the part more attractive to play.
What appealed to you at the moment Jesse Armstrong came to you and said, you know what, I got this thing in mind and I think it's for you?
Well, it's kind of weird because, you know, I've been doing this for quite a few weeks. It's so odd that I always knew when I was a younger actor, I always knew it was going to be about the long game. I had an instinct for that. I knew it was going to be about the long game. And I knew that the roles would get more and more interesting as I got older. And that has turned out to be the case. It's absolutely come true. And then when you get a part like that, like Logan Roy, which has so much in it, and yet so much you can bring to it because it's quite mysterious as a character. And he has these children. I had to ask Jesse in the first weeks, I said, does he like his children? Uh-huh. And he said, oh no, he loves his children. And I said, yeah, I think he does, but he doesn't show it very much, but I think he does love them. But the problem is, they don't come up to scratch.
And I wonder if there's a little bit of that differentiation. He clearly does love them. They all have problems.
That's right.
All have, you know, they're all self-defeating, and yet, I wonder if he likes them.
The thing is that there are certain qualities that he will never admit to anyone about what he likes about his children, and they are his children. But also he knows that the problems they have are the problems that these kids have who have this sense of entitlement, you know, that's unearned. And therefore they feel they have this kind of right to things which, you know, for him, it came a lot harder, a lot tougher. And he got it. And when he got it, he certainly held on to it. So there's this sort of conflict with his kids all the way through. And then the whole premise of trying to find the successor.
It does seem to be the eternal way. It seems a source of frustration for him, and it seems a source through it, or the means through which he manages to torture all these kids. Yeah. I want to play a tweak here from one of the clips in which, again, it's Logan Roy. He's the patriarch and CEO of Waystar Royco. It's got a conservative cable news outlet.
Yeah.
It owns newspapers and tabloids and has satellite offerings all over.
The works.
The works. The question is when Roy will yield control of the next generation and to whom. His second son, Kendall, appears poised to take the reins when, in this scene from the first season, Roy suggests his retirement may not be so imminent after all.
Also, I already mentioned to Kendall, despite the chatter and all things considered, I'm going to give it a couple of years.
As in?
I'll stay in situ as chairman, CEO, head of the firm.
Dad, you what?
I just said, son, or we're not listening as usual.
But I'm, but you're not, what?
It's no big deal. I'm staying on. We can discuss the details.
You didn't tell me.
We can announce you're in pole position, pending events, a move up or whatever.
Pending events?
Okay, come on, let's eat.
He's just devoured him, right?
Well,
there.
I mean, you know, it's very funny because when I was informed about, you know, there was an interest in me for the job, and my agent said, oh, it's only a one season role. I said, oh, okay, fine. And I had this conversation with Adam McKay and Jesse. Adam was in L.A. and Jesse was in Italy, and I was in London. We were at this conference call. And I said, so it's only a one season, after a lot of talk. So I said, it's a one season part, that's it. And there was a long pause, and they said, both of them together, no, I don't think so. I think it's going to be longer. And, you know, and it's fascinating. And, of course, the other thing, the key thing, and the most important thing about Succession is it's a morality tale. It's a modern morality tale. It's about the problems that we are witnessing every day on the news about entitlement and people who are elected to positions that they have not necessarily earned in any form. Now, that cannot be said about Logan. It can be said about Logan that he is skewed in one particular direction because he's pretty right-wing. He's almost as right as Attila the Hun, you know, in that mm-hmm. sense. And he has that Attila the Hun killer instinct. But at the same time, he is also trying to sort out what the future will be and how that future is consecrated in terms of his children. And he finds rather late in the day that his children are wanting. So he doesn't know how he's going to develop the skills that he feels they need. So each series deals with a particular child in a particular way, and that's what's so interesting about the show.
We have a call now from Lexington, Kentucky, from a viewer. Rick, thanks for listening and thanks for calling in today. What's your question for Brian Cox?
Hi. Big fan, Brian. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm curious about the preparation for the role and how you prepared. And did you determine that there were certain families either here or across the pond that you would use as sort of a base or foundation from which you would launch your character from there? And how much do you think Dad has in his own dysfunction lent the sense of entitlement to his children that they have? How mm-hmm. much is he responsible for? Thank you very much.
Well, I think ultimately, though he may not, you know, if you're looking at it objectively, ultimately, of course, he's incredibly responsible for it. I'm not sure he views that. I grew up in a town called Dundee, which is on the east coast of Scotland, and it was run by a family. The press, in fact, it's probably, it used to be, I don't know if it's the biggest paper in the world in circulation, which is read by Canadians, Australians, because of expatriate Scots, called the Sunday Post. And this family, called the Thompsons, they ran it. And they ran it in such a very strict way. I mean, for instance, if you were a Catholic, you could never work for this firm.
That's strict.
And my brother tried to work for the firm as a bachelor, just taking newspapers and dropping them off, but he couldn't even get that job. Huh. So they were run by these guys who lived in Fife. Now, Fife is on the Dundee's on the River Tay, so they have to cross the Tay to come to work every day. And in those days, there was no bridge. They used to come by ferry. And they were like, there were sort of these cadaverous, thin Scotsmen who ran this. And notoriously, they Churchill was the MP of my hometown in the 20s, between 1908 and 1922, when he got kicked out. And they hated Churchill. They hated him because he crossed party. And they would never refer to him by name. So there was this, when Churchill died in 1964, there was this character called Mr. Jack Thompson. He was this conniving Scot who talked like that. And he said, Mr. Jack, we've got to do something about the Sir Winston's death. We need to. What do we need to do? He said, well, we'll have to do some kind of, obituary. Oh, it's very simple. And they said, well, just Ward Premier dies, that's it.
And with that, we're going to come back in just a moment after the break. We're discussing the drama and intrigue of the hit TV series Succession with the star Brian Cox. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the HBO series Succession and the acting career of the show's star, Brian Cox. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have about the characters and plot turns of Succession? What themes do you find embedded in the show? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me here in studio in New York City is Brian Cox, star of HBO's Succession, where he portrays Logan Roy, CEO of a giant media conglomerate, Waystar Royco. He's also starring now as Lyndon Johnson in The Great Society, which opens here in New York on Broadway next Tuesday night. I wanted to play a clip that takes us to the heart of some of the relationships there. It's a tough one. It's a plot twist from the end of the show's first season, in which his seeming heir apparent and his second son, Kendall Roy, drives off a bridge in the UK when heading out with a caterer to try to score some drugs. Kendall flees the site, and Logan offers this advice. Kendall is played by Jeremy Strong.
Go to the desert. Try yourself out. You have not been yourself.
There's nothing. I don't think. And I wasn't there, so.
This could be the defining moment of your life. It'd eat everything. A rich kid kills a boy. You'd never be anything else. Or you know, it could be what it should be. Nothing at all. A sad little detail at a lovely wedding. Where father and son are reconciled.
Brian Cox, it struck me during that scene that there were a lot of layers to what was going on there.
Yeah, yeah.
You have him with a son he loves.
Mm-hmm.
You have him with his heir apparent jockeying for the throne.
Mm-hmm.
You have him there talking about an episode in which a rich kid kills a boy.
Mm.
What is Where's Logan Roy at that moment?
Well, he has to assess things very quickly in this situation, and I don't want to use a swear word here, but he makes more and more mess ups, shall we say?
Definitely done.
You know, and I think that this is, it's part of what, you know, how these children have been brought up, how they've been neglected, and how they've been abused by the situation of their birth, and by also a father who has not taken any prisoners in relationship to who they are. And I think that of course he has these mixed feelings about his children, that he adores them, he absolutely adores them, but at the same time he knows that they can't come up. I mean, Kendall fails because he has the drug problem, and he ends up, you know, doing this, going off on this stupid thing with this boy, and the boy is killed, and the ramifications you'll see as it comes into the second. We deal with it again. In fact, we just dealt with it last week. Mm-hmm. We return there to the house.
And here during the middle of the second season.
Yeah, second season. And Kendall was suitably traumatized. But this trauma in his children is very deep. So in a way, he's saying, you know, kind of partly all bets are off, but at the same time, I have to take an account where these kids are. And how that what they're going to have to learn, and I don't want to give anything away, but there are things that they learn through the second series, which are coming apparent about what they have to be, which isn't very pleasant, mm-hmm. but it's also based on in Logan's credo, you know, what he believes, how he believes as a self-made man, how as a man who's, you know, I've kind of invented a backstory, which is actually to do with the irony of, again, one of the ironies of the show was, when we started the show, I was born in Quebec, Canada. Mm-hmm. So I was playing with a sort of American-Canadian accent. And then in the ninth episode, Peter Friedman said, oh, I've just done some ADR. They've changed your birthplace. I said, what? They've changed your birthplace. I said, well, what do you mean they've changed my birthplace? I've been doing nine episodes. He said, yeah, you're not born, we're not born in Quebec anymore. And I said, well, Mom. He said, oh, I can't remember. He said, let me look. And he looked on his iPhone. He said, oh, here you are. Yes, Dundee, Scotland. And I said, but that's where I'm born. You know, that's my hometown. So there was this kind of sort of fusion of stuff. And then I realized that my experience with that newspaper family, the Thompsons, sort of was, you know, kind of seeping into me in the preparation of the role. Mm-hmm. And that kind of, so the Scots thing, because I actually originally suggested playing at Scots, but Jesse didn't want it. Adam McKay was very keen, but Jesse didn't want
it. Adam McKay, the other producer.
The other producer, yeah, and the director of the first episode, sure. The pilot. And he said, no, well, it's got to be American, so we went along with that. But now, because they've understood something about the sort of toughness of the Scots mentality. And, of course, there's a great newspaper tradition. I mean, Murdoch, for God's sake.
Well, I was going to say, like, you know, I went to his childhood home in Australia, yeah. And if you go to where his father was raised, it was in the back of a Scottish Presbyterian church.
That's right.
Because the grandfather had been sent there from Scotland.
That's right. So that strong influence is there. So I thought this was a very good thing because it kind of gives him that sort of Presbyterian absolutism. Of dealing, except he's actually a Catholic, which is the complicated
right.
thing. So he had to lie to get himself in to the firm, the original firm. My backstory is that he probably learned his journalism in Dundee, you know, as
That's
a journalist.
Fabulous.
You know, so I was able to weave that through, and I think with, you know, with Jesse's sanction, you know.
But sort of retaining a bit of an anger over the idea that all this is being handed to the kids because of what I did.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, like, he loves these kids, but he's kind of pissed at them, too.
Oh, he's very pissed at them. He's very pissed because they haven't owned up to certain things. I mean, he's well pissed with them because they haven't achieved what he feels they should have achieved. And yet it's very difficult to describe what it is. But it's a sense of independence, a sense of not needing. And that's been his problem, is that he has not needed anything. He's been a loner for so long in his life that he's kind of isolated himself.
I should add, we've mentioned Jeremy Strong, who plays Kendall Roy. Of course, some of the other children played by Kieran Culkin, who plays his son Roman. Yeah. And I'm glad to see it on the list in front of me because they use so many nicknames, Romulus, Rome, and other things. I wondered what the given name was. And Shiv Roy is played by the Australian actress, Sarah Snook. They're very funny, very sharp.
And they're tremendous. Those kids are tremendous. They are.
We've got people calling in. Joe is calling in from Syracuse, New York. Joe, thanks for listening. What's your question for Brian Cox?
Thanks for having me. First of all, I think Brian Cox is a brilliant actor. I've been a fan of the show since the first episode, but I struggled to get past the first episode because I couldn't connect with I couldn't find any of the characters likable. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I stuck it out. My question is whether or not you had concerns as an actor of playing a character that is off the bat not very likable. And the second part of the question is, what am I missing? Who of the characters do you find some redeeming qualities in?
Thank you so much for that, Joe, and thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. So Brian Cox, I'd heard this from other people who found the first episode tough. These are some tough, flinty people in a lot of directions and clamoring and climbing over one another, right? Can you identify things that are admirable and likable in Logan and the kids?
There are things, but it's recognizing something that is kind of universal. And that's why the series works. People they become addicted to it. I mean, the stuff, the Twitter stuff and all the stuff, I mean, I don't even go into half of it, but they are so obsessed with the show because people like dislikable characters. They get under the skin. They see it because it reflects on who you are and your own sense of morality and dubiousness of what you feel about certain things. So in a way, you go, oh, no, I can't stand this. I don't like this. And then finally, the show gets under your skin and you become hooked, like our friend. And I think that the great thing is it's the writing. It's all about the writing, and it's about the fact that there is a kind of mission behind the writing. It's not just – it's entertaining, it's funny, it's witty, it's all of that. But it is actually saying something quite profound about our time.
And when you mentioned at the top of the hour that this was a morality tale.
Yes.
What do you think the story it's telling is?
Well, the story it's telling us is that how quickly we lose touch with who we are as human beings. And what we sacrifice for that, and the needless sacrifice that goes on the way. You know, ambition, which, as Shakespeare says, overreaches itself and falls on the other side. And that's the danger of ambition. I mean, we're witnessing it daily in the news. I mean, look, you know, I need to talk about it. We're seeing it now. We're seeing it, what's happening, you know, with the present situation, you know, this impending possible impeachment. Mm-hmm. And we realize where that comes from. And that comes from, you know, probably an abused child, you know, who's decided he was going to make it. He was going to do it. He was going to make it happen no matter what. And became Pinocchio, except the nose didn't grow, you know, but the lies are unbelievable. So that's so reflective of what is going on. And I think the show hits that. There's a sort of zeitgeist about the show. It's hit something very profound. And people are seeing that. And how it unravels is, you know, because there is an arc to it. And Jesse, it's a secret. We don't know what that arc is. I don't know if I'm going to be gone by the end of the third series.
Right.
We've just been renewed for a third series. But that's the power of the show.
You alluded to the Trumps, obviously, of course, that Trumps, at least famously, Fred Trump, the father, could be withholding of affection and other things. And that seems to be certainly
a
theme that we see time and again.
And that effect of withholding affection, the effect that has on a child and how that child develops and how that child goes into middle age and actually lives its life. It ain't good. And we've got these wonderful actors who betray, and of course, his favorite child is Shiv, his daughter.
His daughter.
He loves his daughter. He just loves his daughter, but also he finds his daughter wanting.
It sounds to me as though, it seems to me in this show, it finds her, she just trips over herself. She cannot help herself from pushing the issue.
Yeah, and it
alienates him even as he likes her best.
Yeah, she can't keep her mouth shut. You know, she's just too impulsive.
And because he's the kind of parent he is, he's willing to have a favorite, as opposed to, you know, all parents being told.
Well, exactly. You know, but the point is that there is levels of love, and also there's levels of the appreciation changes because he sees things like he's seeing now. He's beginning to see Roman's potential, which he didn't feel about because Roman was quite young and quite scatty and did, you know, behave really rather stupidly when he was running the film business in L.A. And he now is beginning to see that Roman has got some kind of quality. So it's a shifting thing all the time. And that's what makes it exciting from a playing point of view, because it's endlessly rewarding.
I want to take another caller from another viewer of the show, listener to ours, from Hagerstown, Maryland. Archie's calling. Archie, tell us what you think of the show and what questions you might have for Brian Cox.
Hi, Mr. Cox. You're an absolutely fabulous actor. As you said previously, I am one of the viewers who is addicted to this show. The only reason why I subscribe to HBO is so I can watch your show. I think your acting is brilliant.
Thank
you. The writing of the show, this is the best written show that I've seen on television since Killing Eve. Mr. Cox, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Killing Eve, Eve.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. So the acting is so good, Mr. Cox, that I absolutely hate Roman. I think Shiv is an imbecile. Kendall is a good right-hand man, and you wrap it all up.
Oh, thank you for that, Archie. So we elicits a strong emotions on that, right?
Oh, yeah, it does.
So you've talked about the writing, which is crisp, and it is, folks who haven't seen it, it is a dramatic show with dark veins of humor coursing through it.
Yeah.
At the same time, there's an interview with Adam McKay, right? So he, for folks who might not know, he was a longtime partner with Will Ferrell and as a producer on this. He did The Big Short and other movies. And he's
– And did the movie about Dick Cheney.
And he did do just the movie just about Dick Cheney with Christian Bale.
Yeah.
So he gave a conversation – in an interview, he talked about how he had urged the cast, in addition to paying attention and honor the writing, to add some spontaneity to the mix. He explained this in an interview he gave to The Hollywood Reporter.
We had some classically trained actors who just looked me straight in the eyes and told me there's no way I'm improvising. And sure enough, on the day, we would get there and I would yell out, hey, try this. And they would go, no. And the whole crew would get still for a second. And I would just say, we're rolling. You might as well. And then they would start to do it. And of course, they would fall in love with it. I mean, every actor does.
So at the tail of that, he says there's a family dinner scene, and I assume that's where their discussion of whether they buy something equivalent to the Wall Street Journal, New York Times companies. There's the family dinner scene that's the birthday for Logan, and that's entirely improvised. Oh, maybe that's a different one. He says that's entirely improvised. I give everyone their own conversation they were going to have, and they did it like three times in a row. They were incredible. What has the spirit of improvisation been on
the
set?
It's amazing. I mean, the master of it, I think – I mean, I think they're all pretty good. I mean, they're all excellent. But the surprising one, who really didn't want to improvise and was sort of set against it, was Kieran Culkin.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he's brilliant. He is absolutely brilliant. And now he can't stop improvising. I mean, it was astonishing. It was like, you know, releasing a dog from a sort of, running after a hare. You know, he just went for it. And he was very nervous about it, but he's become a master, an absolute master of improvising.
We've got a minute left before the end of this second segment, and we'll come back after that. What have you learned about Logan Roy in the course of this that you didn't realize at the outset?
Well, I didn't realize that he was, what I've learned is he's not a fixed point. He's a shifting point. And also he is dark in the sense of his background, in the sense of who he is. And so there's a lot to be dug out there, you know.
It seems to me as though he's a figure who – you're saying he's not fixed. And you don't just mean that in terms of who he favors at the moment. You mean in terms of what he's convinced himself he believes at the moment.
That's right. That's right. And it has to be a shifting point because he's – you know, he goes after the Pierces because he thinks he wants a kind of legitimacy. But these are people he can't stand. Because they're sort of American Brahmins.
Could be the Salzburgers, could have been the Bancrofts who owned the Wall Street Journal.
And he really can't bear those people because he's rough and ready. And that's the thing that makes him a little bit more edgy than perhaps even Murdoch or any of those other guys are because he's much more rough and ready.
There's a scene at the end where he's pounding the window of the limousine going away of the woman who sort of runs the family that owns that paper. It's very striking as though suddenly he is impotent. in a world that he is expected to control. We're talking the illustrious acting career of Brian Cox, star of HBO's Succession. He's in studio. We'll be talking about his stage career as well. Join our conversation. Next week marks the Broadway opening of The Great Society here in New York City. Cox plays LBJ. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmanning, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking with the actor Brian Cox about his career on screen and stage. You can join our conversations. What questions do you have for my guest? Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me, as I mentioned, Brian Cox. He's star of HBO's Succession, where he portrays Logan Roy, the CEO of a giant media conglomerate. He's also starring as Lyndon Johnson in The Great Society, which opens at Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theater right here in New York City next Tuesday night. I want to start with just a clip to remind listeners of your, you know, decades-long work on stage. Brian Cox has been on stage in Britain with the Royal Shakespeare Company, the National Theater, and of course here on Broadway. Here he is performing from Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus during an appearance on the BBC's acting series program.
Two of our brothers were condemned to death. My hand cut off and made a merry jest, both her sweet hands, her tongue, and that more dear than hands or tongue, her spotless chastity. Inhuman traitors! You constrained and forced!
Brian Cox, each syllable and pause carrying a meaning.
God, that's from a long time ago.
Takes you back. Tell me a little bit about taking on LBJ as a character. How do you place him and how do you approach a role like that?
Well, it's so weird because I really thought my days of doing that kind of theater were over. I mean, I actually felt that this was, you know, Succession's great. I love the show. And I thought, oh, I can now. I'm a certain age, so I thought, well, I can do my show and then take it. And then, of course, from outfield, you know, comes LBJ. And we were originally supposed to do it as a dramatized reading. We put that show on in 3 weeks.
3 weeks?
3 weeks.
So I saw it Tuesday night. It looked awfully good, tight. I mean, it's an ensemble cast. Much of it, of the your colleagues in the cast are playing multiple roles.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think the same guy is playing George Wallace, the segregationist governor of Alabama, as well as Richard Nixon.
That's right.
You know,
who
succeeds Johnson.
That's right.
You know, that was a lot of smooth work.
We did that with it. We had 3 day technical. We had, which is unheard of in the theater.
Which means you're mapping out like where the lights will be,
everything,
and how it works.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The mic.
And we had our final dress rehearsal, our final technical rehearsal, and our first preview on the same night.
And how long ago was that?
That was 2 weeks ago.
Right. And so I saw it, you know, just a few, 3 days ago.
Yeah.
So, you know.
So we've been, originally we were going to do it as a dramatized reading. And then Bill
Raj.
When
did that change?
Well, Bill Raj, he called me and he said, do you think you could go for it? And I said, well, I'll try. I said, I don't know what my learning skills are because I haven't done this kind of theater because it is Shakespearean. I haven't done it since I did King Lear, you know, almost 30 years ago. You know, and I was young then, but I had the energy. But apparently I've still got the energy.
Well, that's right. When you talk about what is do a difference, like, it seems obvious, but it's worth reminding. And you do something like, what, 6-8 performances a week. It is live. That's it is several hours long.
That's
and by the way, LBJ turns out to be the main character of LBJ's life.
That's right. And of course, the great thing about LBJ is he is this – he is a really Shakespearean figure. I mean, he's a tragic, tragic figure. A man who realized that, you know, from his own profound ignorance of foreign affairs and the whole ignorance of Vietnam and the horror of Vietnam, which is truly, it's you cannot apologize enough for Vietnam, because it's just was such, you know, the waste, the incredible waste, and the needlessness of it, and the fact that Ho Chi Minh, he was, you know, he's not Kim Jong Un, he was a freedom fighter who became a, who led a country, and it's now a very successful country as a result,
which trades with us.
Yeah, which trades with us. That's the irony, and when you think of all those foreign American boys, and you know, it's just horrendous.
So Robert Schenken, the playwright, a Pulitzer winner, he had written an earlier installment in this drama.
All the Way, which is about from Kennedy's assassination up until the point where he got his re-election.
And Bryan Cranston played that on Broadway and on HBO, their version, their film version. Yeah. When your approach for this, you think about him as a tragic figure. One of the things that's made is that you're reminded of as a viewer of the play is the tragedy in some ways is not that, you know, a Greek irony where he's unaware of a development. He's aware from the outset that this is going to be a disaster. And he's aware of the fact it could imperil the good he wants to do.
That's right.
And that, you know, he already had growth as a Texan of a certain part of the state, that he had to come to the idea of desegregation and integration. He had to come to the idea. Well, I guess he lived poor, so he understood
that. He knew
that.
About it. No. That's his background speaks for itself. He was poor. I mean, his father was a sort of farmer, but not successful, rancher. And the land that they apparently the soil was only so thick, so they couldn't actually feed their cattle properly. So he was from that kind of background, but he had no sense of the world. Apparently, he used to when he met Oriental children or Chinese children.
We tend to say Asian these days,
Asian. He used to tap them on the head, and of course that's something you never do. Mm-hmm. Of course he did it because he was a Westerner, so he had no sense. He had no sense of what was. What was foreign, what was non-American. Mm-hmm. But his sense of the reality of civil rights, the reality of voting rights, the reality of proper education is so astonishing. And there, and he did it. Kennedy, of course, kicked it all off. But then Kennedy was a Brahmin from the North. They weren't going to... He knew how to deal with those Southern Democrats. That Johnson had the skill to do that. And, of course, the great thing in the play... And the great moral issue in the play is once you've told your first lie, and that's the thing in his life, because he's constantly, he's talking about, oh my God, he's lying. And he says, the reason I lied was to do certain things. I could only achieve it in certain ways. But then he says, towards the end of the play, he said, but then you've got to cover up with another one and another one and another one. So one day you don't know where you are anymore or who you are and what you've been doing. And all you can see is the mayhem that's been caused as a result of Vietnam, for example. So it's a fascinating element. And I mean, I love Robert's writing in that way because he really is dealing with such a big subject. And what I also love is the fact it's about American history. And we don't see a lot of American history. You guys are not very good at your own history, you know. I mean, I have to say, you know, I come from a
culture. And we have less of it.
Well, you have, but you have it as stormy. I mean, it really is stormy.
Yeah.
You know, I was very lucky to do Deadwood, working with the great David Milch. So that was, you know, clear about what that was all about as well, you know, the sort of mayhem of that. But
the
violence, you know, and this is what's so interesting about Johnson. Johnson came at a particular time, and he was in many ways a great president because all those civil rights, all that came through him at the most incredible time when, you know, the marches in Selma, what was happening to Martin Luther King, the split in their movement between Stokely Carmichael, Martin Luther King, Bob Moses, all of that. And it was all happening within the space of 3 or 4 years. And that's what's so extraordinary. And it's so great that Robert writes his play, which is like a Shakespearean historical play.
It is. It felt like that.
It's like Henry VI or Henry IV, Part yep. One. It's about those things that shape a country, shape a system. You know?
I want to take a call and then get back to that question. I want to take a call from Marla, who's been waiting patiently for us. Marla's calling from Middlebury, Connecticut. Thanks for listening today, Marla.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to see the Great Society last weekend at Lincoln Center, and so happy to see you, Brian Cox, such a beautiful, incredible production and performance, and two powerful men, of course, Logan Roy, and then LBJ. And I'm an acting teacher. I teach high school theater here in Middlebury, and I'm just very interested in, of course, the actor's approach, and wondered if you could talk briefly about, you know, how you approached, like maybe significant things about approaching both of those roles. Of course, it's a very long conversation, but if you had any insights, that would be really great to hear.
Thank you, Marla, for that call. Maybe talk a little bit about approaching LBJ in particular.
Well, the thing that you've got to avoid when creating a character is judgment. You mustn't judge characters. You have to see them in their own light, and you have to see the really where they've come to, how they've come to certain decisions, rightly or wrongly. You know, if you're playing Adolf Hitler or you're playing Winston Churchill, you have to look at their journey. Now, you know, Adolf Hitler there's such a cliche element to it, but at the same time, he was this failed painter. He had a kind of vision of something. And he had a particular historic period. And also he had enormous help from people like Goering and a whole coterie of people around him who sort of supported him. So you don't judge. You never judge characters. You allow the audience to judge them. That's for the audience to do, not for you to do. You have to present who they are. And it's what, you know, I always go back to the bard Shakespeare. He talks about holding the mirror up to nature. You know, showing, you know, its own form. And that's precisely what you do when you're playing roles like LBJ or Logan. You have to show them who they are. And therefore, the better you're at it doing that, the more interesting the audiences become, because they recognize something that they know they don't necessarily like, but they understand where it's coming from. And it's the same with playing somebody like LBJ. LBJ is flawed individual, extremely flawed, kind of rough, brutal sort of sometimes, but also a seductor. I mean, a great seducer, a great way that he can spin plates, an extraordinary character. But again, this flaw, which is to do with lying, and that's the thing which was finally what he felt was his undoing. And then to have the extraordinary courage to say, I ain't doing this no more because I've just made a mess of it. I'm not doing it. I'm out. And not very many American presidents would do that. You can't see them doing that when they finally say, you know, this is not my time to.
So there's Brian Cox offering some advice to actors and to acting instructors. So we have a clip here that went viral once again this week. I think it's from might have been first posted in 2015, but regardless, here's Brian Cox giving a masterclass to a 2-year-old boy named Theo. I guess it was actually back in 2009. It involves a soliloquy you've probably heard once or twice, but not quite like this.
So you go to be, or not to be. That is the question.
That's the question.
Yes.
I like that.
That's good. That's good. To be or not to be. That is the question.
Brian Cox, in that full clip, you just show such joy in it. You've gotten him there, and he's sort of looking quizzically, but he's playing it back with you.
Oh, no, he's amazing. It's children are the best actors. Uh-huh. They are, you know, people go on about, oh, children, what have you, and what. But I've always found, and actually, interestingly enough, and I think that's one of, for example, Kieran Culkin's great qualities is he was a brilliant child actor, and he's brought it on. I mean, he's still got that. He's still got that ability to come at something without baggage. He just does that thing that children do brilliantly well. And Theo, who was, you know, not, he's not an actor. I mean, he's now 12 now. He's off doing stuff. But he just had this thing about language. And I could hear that he could understand. He had a thing about language. So I thought, I'll take him down this route. And it was his father who did the filming of it. And it was one Christmas. We were having breakfast. And we just suddenly did this moment. And and what's so good is the way he gets distracted. And then he comes back to it. Mm-hmm. He goes off, and you let him. And you have to let him go off. You can't, you know, because somebody, you know, a little sterner might say, "Now, pay attention." But don't. You follow his rhythm that allows him to come back to the point again. And then he did. There's a wonderful moment when he does the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, which I never showed him to do or anything. But he does with his gesture, with his hands, when he goes, "The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune." And he throws his hands from side to side. And this is a 2.5-year-old kid who suddenly has something so profound that he knows. And you go, where does that come from? Where does that knowledge come from? And there is a, you know, I mean, there is a great mystery about my job, you know.
You know, as we close out this hour, I wonder, you know, if you can talk to the power of the theater, even in an age of little screens. We're all diverted. We're all expecting things to be short and concise. Mm. We're all expecting them to play out really tightly. Something like The Great Society, a 2.5-3-hour play about LBJ and his legacy and his nature and his character. Tell me about your ability to still feel that you can connect and compel. Do you feel it's still there?
I never thought I'd be doing this again. I thought I would be in the small screen, and that would be my, you know, I would be very happy. But I am a theater-trained animal, and once you're a theater-trained animal, it doesn't leave you. And so it's like, you know, muscle memory. You come on and you do it, and then you get that sense of community. I mean, that's what theater really is. It's absolutely the essence of community, where people are, and it goes right back to the ritual of the people sitting around the fire in primitive times and the stories being told. And that's the focus. And it's a group activity. It's about people. I mean, I remember years and years ago, I worked in Moscow. I taught at the Moscow Arts. And they went back to the old theater because the director, a wonderful man called Alek Efremov, no longer with us, sadly, but he said, well, the problem was that in these modern theaters, you never touched your elbows. He said, you were never in touch with the person next door to you. Whereas in the old theaters, you showed an arm.
Packed.
You were packed. You shared. So there was a sense of community. There was a sense of communal experience. That's unbeatable.
From a man who's played, a mass murderer, a man who's played a flawed American president, a man who plays a despotic media mogul, you've been hearing from the actor, Brian Cox, Emmy Award-winning actor, star of the HBO series Succession and of the new Broadway show The Great Society. Thank you so much for spending time with us
today.
Thank
you. Thank you for that.
You can continue our conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Ilina Amata, Stefana Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, and Grace Tatter, with help from Sharif Campbell, Max Liebman, and Jeffrey Lyne. This show was produced by Adam Waller. Our executive producer is Karen Shipman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.